We've been studying the life of David recently, and it doesn't take real long in a study of his life to come to the conclusion that he's quite a remarkable young man, isn't he? The first exposure we had to him was there in chapter 16 when one of his peers or somebody that knew him sort of introduced him to Saul verbally only. And we saw there in chapter 16 that he was a skillful musician, among other things. Not just a musician, but a skillful one. And he was also a mighty man of valor. Find that combination often if you can. A mighty man of valor, that is a very good harpist, which David was. He was a warrior. And these terms were used of him when he was not yet old enough to even be in the military service of their day. He had to be over 20. And he wasn't that old. And yet they spoke of him in this way. So somebody knew about him from other experiences that categorized him that way, a man of valor and a warrior. He was prudent in speech. He could speak well and had good judgment when to speak and when not to speak as a relatively young man. And on top of all that, he was handsome. Good-looking young man. Not a bad package so far, huh? And the Lord was with him. It was known about him that he was a godly young man, as evidenced by the Lord's blessing on his life. All of that just came out of chapter 16, we first introduced to him before he did anything. That's an unusual, admirable combination of traits, isn't it? Have all those things going for you. And David did. In chapter 17, we saw that he had a shepherd's heart. He was a shepherd. Usually people like that are caring and responsible people that can take care of a flock like that, and he was that way. He was very brave. Remember, he killed a bear and a lion, both more or less by hand. I mean, he might have had some kind of a club-like weapon, but not a spear or a bow and arrow or a sword or anything like that. And so he was a very brave young man to approach wild animals like that to try to deliver a lamb out of their mouth. He prioritized the things of God's kingdom in his life, clearly by the reaction he had to Goliath's dissing God and his people. He didn't like that at all. And clearly he was a man of faith, as evidenced by his confrontation with Goliath, where the circumstances would be, just humanly speaking, the odds would be just impossible for him to win that fight. Yet he stepped right into it, trusting God to deliver him and to silence the negativity coming out of Goliath's mouth about God and his people, and he did. We saw that. In chapter 18, we saw he was very responsible toward his duties. Saul put him in charge of more and more in his kingdom, in his realm, and he was well liked by everybody. Usually guys like that are doing good jobs and being fair and reasonable and all that stuff in it, and if everybody likes him. He was a humble young man. Remember, he would not take Saul's daughter for his wife because he didn't feel like he was worthy of her. He didn't have the money or the social position of his family to feel like that was just, and so he demurred that offer from Saul to take his eldest daughter. He was very successful in fighting God's enemies. I bet the Philistines hated to see that guy coming. He whipped up on them every time. He was hell on wheels toward the Philistines. Very successful in fighting God's enemies. And clearly in chapter 19, we see that God's hand was on this young man's life. So his character, as it's developed in the first several chapters here in 1 Samuel, is very, very admirable. I mean, who wouldn't like to be like this? I mean, just that handsome part would be worth having, wouldn't it? And the character's traits are very, very admirable, to say the least. And so he's our first exposure to him in these first several chapters is a good one. I don't know how you would come away not admiring this young man. And he certainly was an extraordinary combination of traits and godliness in a relatively young man. Who else is sort of similar to that we see in Scripture? Can you think of somebody else that exhibited similar sort of traits? Admirable godliness at a relatively young age? Yeah, Daniel. Remember, Daniel was the same way. He was probably mid to late teens when he was taken into exile down there in Babylon, and he did the same thing. He made his mind up. He was not going to follow Nebuchadnezzar's godless ways, and he worked at it in a proper way, but he was very admirable as well. Daniel and David, up to this point in his life at least, are very, very admirable biblical characters. But when we got to chapter 20 here in David's life, in 1 Samuel chapter 20, things kind of took a little bit of a turn for the downside. He had been rejected by Saul, who's become almost a total nutcase at this point in time, and Saul was trying to take his life. Seems like David spent a lot of time developing a quick shuttle to the left to dodge Saul's spear throws at him. Saul had already tried to kill him a time or two, or three. And so he is sort of running for his life now from Saul. And in chapter 20, we see David ask his good friend Jonathan, Saul's son, to lie for him in an attempt to try to find out whether Saul really did want to kill him or not. David was going to not attend a certain feast that Saul would be at, and Saul would notice that he wasn't there, of course. And so David asked Jonathan to lie to Saul on David's behalf to see if he could figure out whether or not Saul really did still want to kill him. What was the outcome of that lie that Jonathan did indeed participate in with him? What'd Saul do to Jonathan? He practiced that spear throw again, didn't he? Threw a spear at his own son at this feast. Tried to kill his own son because he concluded that his son had sided with Jonathan instead of him, Saul, and so he literally tried to kill him. So the lie that David asked Jonathan to participate in almost resulted in the death of his best good friend, Jonathan. So that was kind of a black mark on his record so far. That was a chink in the armor. It was a characteristic that we hadn't seen up to this point in time, and we'll see how it goes as we go forward. Then we come to chapter 21, where we want to continue on here today. And in chapter 21, we have, in essence, the beginning of this chart right here. This chart maps David's movements during the roughly 10 years or so that he was in exile from Saul. The places he fled to and where he kind of hung out for a while and this sort of thing. So you can kind of see all that movement up there. It begins up here in the upper right-hand corner when Saul went from David, good grief, David went from here up to Ramah where Samuel lived, and that was kind of the first leg, I guess we could say, of this flight. And we see sort of the second leg here this morning in chapter 21. So David came to Nob. You see where Nob is on this map? Next city down here, it's right here. So he came down from Ramah down to Nob. That's what, maybe a whopping 4 or 5 mile journey, something like that, not too far away. So he comes down to there, and Ahimelech, the priest, was there. Nob is the city where the priests hung out, lived, dwelt, and so Ahimelech is there. And so when David comes up to him by himself, Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" Now Ahimelech smells a rat right off the bat. David's by himself. This individual at this level in Saul's court would normally not ever be by himself. He would have an entourage, a bodyguard if nothing else. And so when Ahimelech sees him, he thinks, maybe something isn't quite right here. And so he says, "Well, why are you here?" Ahimelech, the high priest, says, "Why are you here by yourself?" And David said to Ahimelech, the priest, "The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, 'Let no one know anything about the matter on which I'm sending you and with which I have commissioned you, and I have directed the young men to a certain place.'" Is that true? David says, "I'm on this covert operation, Ahimelech. I'm on special ops duty here, and nobody's supposed to know what I'm up to." Well, that's just a bold-faced lie, wasn't it? That isn't true. He's fleeing, he's running from Saul, but he acts like he's alone because he's on a secret mission. And he goes on to say in verse 3, "Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found." In other words, "Man, I need something to eat here, high priest. Can you help me out? Just some loaves of bread, you know, whatever you got. I'll take anything you have." And the priest answered David and said, "Well, there's no ordinary bread on hand, but there is the consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women." That's a deal you don't get to eat if you've been around a woman. What kind of a deal is that? They don't have any regular bread there at the priest's quarters in Nob, but they have the showbread, the stuff that they put out on the table on a regular basis, on that table of showbread in the tabernacle. You remember that back in Leviticus when they built that thing. That's all they've got. And Ahimelech says, well, listen, I can give you that, but the people with you, who he doesn't see because there's no one with him, they have to be ceremonially pure, or I can't even give it to you either. And so David, and of course, if they had been in contact with a woman within a day, they would not be, and so they wouldn't be able to get this. And David says, he just continues to lie a little bit and says, no, they're okay. They haven't been with anybody. They're clean. So David answered the priest, surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out, and the vessels of the young men were holy, though it was an ordinary journey. How much more then today will their vessels be holy? In other words, he acts like, well, everything's fine. You can go ahead and give me that bread. So the priest gave him consecrated bread, and there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. So they would rotate that bread in and out. I think it was once a week, by the way, that it was replaced, but I can't remember that for certain. But the priest goes ahead then and gives David this bread that had been set apart, consecrated to the Lord's service there in the tabernacle at Nob, because of what David told Ahimelech. He thinks it's okay. Now, one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg. He's an Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. Now, this guy is not a natural-born Jew. He's an Edomite. He's a Gentile. What's he doing? Why is he detained at the tabernacle? He must be involved in some sort of a oath or something like that he's discharging. There's some reason why he was hanging around this place, and he is Saul's man. So he sees David, and he knows what's going on there. So we'll see how this storyline works out. And David said to Ahimelech, is there not a spear or a sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent. You see how easy it is to just keep a lie going once you start one? Just easy, just keep it going, just add another element to it, another little phase to it, and that, unfortunately, is what's happening with David here. He's just continuing his lie, expanding it to include whatever he needs to. He says he had no weapon because King's matter was just so urgent, he couldn't arm himself like he normally would. So he's added a lie to a lie to a lie. And the priest said to him, not knowing anything about it, of course, he said, well, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it, for there is no other except it here. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. So he lies about his mission. He lies about the condition of his men concerning the bread. He lies about why it is he has no weapon. Every step along here now is just another facet to David's lying. So he gets this weapon, but the guy who is Saul's chief shepherd was there. So then David arose, and he fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. Who was from Gath? Remember that little guy we saw back in chapter 17? This is Goliath's hometown. He's over here. Remember, the Philistine cities are Ekron, Gath. Yeah, that ain't one. But at any rate, they're all right in through here. This is where the Philistines were. So David now leaves Nob, where the high priest was, and travels over here to a city of the Philistines, the hometown of Goliath. I don't think he's still carrying his head around with him, but he did for a while. And that's where he goes. He goes over to there. Why would you seek refuge amongst God's enemies if you were David? Is that a good plan, you think? This philosophy that we see David using here is one that you'll see, well, you won't see it necessarily, but it will be at work during the tribulation period when Israel signs that false covenant with the Antichrist. Israel will seek help from God's enemies. the Antichrist, the greatest enemy that God will have ever had in the history of the planet, is the one that Israel will sign a peace treaty with to mark the beginning of the tribulation period. Remember that? He'll sign a treaty with the many for 7 years, and in the middle of it, he breaks that treaty and turns on them. They'll do the same thing nationally there that what David is doing here. Instead of turning to God for safety and protection, they will turn to, as he does here, God's enemies. In this case, the Philistines. See what happens when you're walking by fear and instead of faith? You do some really crazy things. Some things that can get you into some serious trouble. And we'll see how this works out. So he goes over to there, Goliath's hometown. But the servants of Achish, the king of that place, or the head or whatever, they said to him, "Well, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they danced, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? Hey, ain't this the guy that people honored and claimed was killing thousands of us? This is the guy you want around you here?" And David hears that understanding, and he took these words to heart, and he greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. "Why did you go there then, David?" But when he realizes that they know who he is, and that he has a reputation among them as the best Philistine killer on the planet, he thinks, "Uh-oh, they may come for me." So what's he do? He disguised his sanity before them and acted insanely in their hands. Scribbled on the doors of the gate and let his saliva run down into his beard. This is God's anointed king of Israel. And he's behaving like this. He's acting insane because he's fearing for his life. Where is God in his thinking? Doesn't appear to be too close at hand, does it? And Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see the man behaving as a madman? Why did you bring him to me? Do I lack madmen that you brought this one to act the madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house?" So he sees him. He says, "What are you doing bringing these nutcases in here? I don't want this guy around me." He says, "I got enough crazy people already here in Achish. I don't need another one." And it's fortunate for David that he reacts in that way instead of saying, "Kill that idiot and get him out of here." He could have easily slain him. This is the Philistines now. And here's David, the greatest Philistine killer on the planet, acting like a nut. And Achish simply says, "Get him away from me. I don't want him around." So he's very, very fortunate that he's not slain by this guy. So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. Okay, so he gets out of there, Gath, now, and he travels over to here. And there was a cave there that he sort of set up as headquarters, cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. Now, where did we last see his brothers? It was in the Goliath incident, wasn't it? They were there in the army, remember? They're a member of Saul's army. They're the ones that jumped on David when he came in there and said, "Hey, I'll take this guy down for you." They kind of criticized him and rebuked him and all that stuff. So his brothers have now, it looks like, at least deserted Saul's army to come and join David. Now, that puts their lives at risk too, doesn't it? If they're deserters out of Saul's army, he's not going to be real happy with that, I'm sure. And so they come over and sort of join up with him there at that cave. And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Now there was about 400 men with him. This is the beginning of David's army. He recruits about 400 different guys who are, what shall we say, malcontents. They're not real happy campers with the way things are wherever they were. So they come and join David. Who's that remind you of? Robin of Locksley? Remember Robin Hood? He's kind of like that, isn't he? He's got this band of guys now that he's put together, sort of on the outside of the system of the day. And they build up to about the tune of 400 guys. So this is the beginning of his military might. His brothers and some other guys who sort of have nothing to lose, so they join up with David. So there at Adullam, he starts to build him a bit of an army. Let's see. So David then went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, so he's going all the way over now to Moab somewhere. Some guys show him coming across. This map shows him coming across here down to the lower part. Others show him going around the top of the Dead Sea and coming over to there. But Moab is over here on the east side of the Dead Sea. Why would he go over there with some of his family members in order to try to find them a refuge? He says, please let my father and my mother come and stay until I know what God will do for me. Why would he go to Moab to expect help? Ruth, explain that to me. Where's his grandmother from? Excuse me, his great-grandmother. Yeah, from Moab. She was a Moabitess, remember? Ruth and Boaz. So there's probably some sort of a familial link there, some sort of a tendency to have compassion for David because his great-grandmother was from there, and they would know that. So he takes his family over there, his father and his mother, and says, can they stay here with you until this whole situation with me running around trying to stay alive is sort of resolved? And they were glad to do that. So he left them there, king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. And the prophet Gad, he has a prophet now with him. Amongst his entourage, he has this guy. And that prophet said, do not stay in the stronghold, depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Herath. So he comes, the stronghold they think was Masada down here. So he comes back from there and then he departs from there after this prophet tells him so. And he comes back up into this general region up here. So he's kind of made a little bit of a loop there. But at least he has a prophet with him that can speak for God to David and provide him guidance and directions there as need be. So he comes back on up into Judah in this forest of Herath, not too far from this city of Keilah. So Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was sitting in Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the right, on the height, with his spear in his hand. And all his servants were standing around him. Would you want to be standing near Saul when he had a spear in his hand, knowing what we know about the guy? No, you'd want to be at least a spear's throw away from him. But they're there anyway. And Saul said to his servants who stood around him, hear now, O Benjamites. Apparently all of his leaders were fellow tribesmen, Benjamites. Saul was a Benjamite. He says, will the son of Jesse, he won't even use his name, will the son of Jesse give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? In other words, who is it, guys, who butters your bread? Is it David or is it me? Who's given you these vineyards and these lands and so on? And who's given you these high-paying positions of commanders and so on? Who's taking care of you guys? For all of you have conspired against me, so that there is no one who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you who is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in ambush as it is this day. He's accusing his leaders of not telling him that David and Jonathan have formed this covenant and that David is out there trying to assassinate him. He says, look, I've been taking care of you guys, and you don't even inform me of things like this. He's dumping on them, in other words. So then Doeg, the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, answered and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Amalek, the son of Ahitub. Remember, he was there. And so now he tells Saul, hey, I saw Jesse come in there and visit the priest up there. And, he goes on to say, he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. Well, he did some of that in ignorance because he didn't know what was going on. Remember, David told him he was on a special black ops operation. He couldn't explain it all to Ahimelech, and so he just needed some help. And Ahimelech did indeed help him. He didn't acquire the Lord for him, so it's not totally true. So Doeg embellishes the story a little bit, apparently to irritate Saul even further. So then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's household. The priests who were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. He's rounded up all of the priesthood that was there at Nob, Saul has, and brought them to him, to Saul. And he said this, "Listen now, son of Ahitub." He won't call him a name either. And he answers, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said to him, "Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, that he should go up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day?" He accuses the high priest of being in cahoots with David and in plotting against him, Saul. Then Ahimelech answers, verse 14, to the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house?" He says, the high priest says, Who is more dear to you, who is more honorable to you, more trustworthy to you than your son-in-law? You made him the captain of your bodyguards. He was right in your midst at any time. If he wanted to kill you, he could have done that in a number of occasions. So he speaks for David, Ahimelech does. He said, "And did I just begin to inquire of God for him today?" That is this something new? Do I not acquire of God for you guys whenever you want me to? "Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father, for your servant knows nothing of all this whole affair." In other words, what are you talking about, Saul? I'm not part of any conspiracy against you. I don't know what you're talking about. And he didn't, because David lied to him. He didn't know the truth of what was going on there. But Saul says in verse 16, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household." Now, if there's any question in anybody's mind concerning the spiritual and mental state of Saul at this point in time, this ought to clear it up real well. What he's just done is pronounced death upon the entire priesthood, Ahimelech and his father's household, all of the priests of God who served the nation there at Nob. Saul has just said, "You're dead meat, because you have plotted against me." So the king said to the guards who were attending him, "Turn around and put the priests of the Lord to death, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me." So he orders the death of all of the priesthood because he thought they were plotting against him. But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hand to attack the priests of the Lord. Similar to that Jonathan incident earlier when Saul made that rash, ridiculous vow about not eating anything till the end of the battle that one day, and everybody was dropping like flies from exhaustion. And Jonathan ate a little bit of honey, and Saul was going to put him to death. And the people wouldn't let him. Same thing as here. His most trusted guards and so on said, no, we're not going to kill God's priesthood for you. So then the king turns to Doeg, this Edomite, remember, who was there at Nob and saw this. "You turn around and attack the priests." And Doeg the Edomite turned around and attacked the priests, and he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. This guy, apparently wanting to ingratiate himself with Saul at any cost, he takes the order and he kills 85 priests of God that day, at Saul's direction. And he went beyond that order. Verse 19, he struck the city of Nob, the city of priests, with the edge of the sword, both men, women, children, infants, also oxen, donkeys, sheep, he struck with the edge of the sword. Saul didn't tell him to go kill the whole city, but he did. Again, probably as an attempt to ingratiate himself with Saul and sort of work his way up the political ladder there in the kingdom. So, what's happened now as a result of David's lies to Ahimelech, the high priest? 85 priests are dead. The whole city is wiped out, man, woman, child, and animal. Now, Saul gave the command. David didn't kill them. Saul gave the command for them to be killed. But David is culpable in that he lied to Ahimelech, and Ahimelech didn't know what the circumstances were of what was going on there. He might have chose a different course of action had he known. Lying, a good thing? Looked like it was working out there, didn't it? Well, it didn't work out for Nob and 85 priests and other people living there. But there was a guy that escaped, one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar. He escaped and fled after David. So there's one of the guys at least got out of there, one priest, one member of that family got away, and Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And David said to Abiathar, "I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household." So David recognizes that he has culpability in this matter. He assumes some responsibility for it here because of his lying. But he says to Abiathar, "Well, stay with me and do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. You're safe with me." So this is the beginning now of David's priesthood. This guy Abiathar, who has come now and fled the massacre there at Nob and joined up with David. So David now has a band of men. He has a prophet in his midst, a guy named Gad, and he now has a high priest who can serve that group as well. So the kingdom of David has begun now with these 400 guys, a priest, and a prophet. And we'll see these guys kind of grow into David's realm as things go on. But the way it came about, as you can see here, is a murderous way on the part of Doeg, but he's actually just following Saul's orders, so really it's at the hands of Saul primarily. Okay, so see what's going on now so far? Small beginning of a kingdom, 400 guys, a priest, and a prophet. So now, as David flees Saul, he's got to provide for and make provisions for this group of 400 guys. It's a little harder to run now, isn't it? You can't just go hide in a cave somewhere if you got 400 guys, 400 mouths to feed and all that. And so things are going to be a little more difficult. Okay, verse 1 of chapter 23. Then they told David, saying, "Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and plundering the threshing floors." Now here's Keilah up here. And what David has learned is that the Philistines are now trying to attack that area, and in particular, steal their grain. It's the time of year where they're threshing their grain, and these Philistines have waited until the Judeans have threshed their grain, and that's when they're going to come and steal it. Who wants to steal it when it's still on the stalk or something like that? And you got to go thresh it. So they're waiting until it's got to that point, and now they're going to try to raid the place and steal their grain. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, now, don't you wish he'd done this before? Here he does. We see a kind of a series of peaks and valleys here, where he sort of at times walks by fear and ignores the Lord, lies and people die and stuff like that. Other times here, he's got the good judgment that he asks of the Lord, should I go up there and attack these guys? You'd wish you'd do that all the time. And the Lord said to David, verse 2, yeah, go attack the Philistines and deliver Keilah. But David's men said to him, behold, we're afraid here in Judah. How much more if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines? Now, the guys are a little bit reluctant now to jump right into this fight. They're saying, hey, look, we're kind of fleeing for our lives here now with you. If we go up there and face the Philistines, what's going to happen to us? And so they ask a little bit about him. The men said to David, we're not sure we want to do this, David. So he inquired of the Lord once more, verse 4, and the Lord answered him and said, arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand. So David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines, and he led away their livestock and struck them with great slaughter. Thus David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah. So even while he's in the process of fleeing Saul, running for his life with his band of merry men, he's still trying to fight the Lord's enemies and deliver the Lord's people, and that's what he did. He goes up here and delivers this place here from the Philistines again. So he's kind of got two lives going on here. One is fleeing from Saul, and the other one is to doing the things that God wants him to do, is fight for his people. Yeah, Tommy?
Yeah, before it said that David inquired of the Lord, is that directly or is that through the prophet?
It would probably be through the prophet or priest that he would do that. They use that ephod. When you see that word ephod, they're talking about a kind of a vest-like thing that the priests wore, and they would use it to determine what God wanted them to do, sometimes using a couple stones, kind of like rolling dice, and whatever number they got, to yes or no type thing. So probably it would go through that priest, Abiathar, and, you know, as compared to going directly himself. But that's usually how they would do it. So he goes up there, whips up on the Philistines, as is normally the case, and delivers the people and takes their booty. So it came about when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, had fled to David at Keilah, that he came down with an ephod in his hand, and that's probably where they got the direction from. And when it was told to Saul that David had come to Keilah, Saul said, "Well, God has delivered him into my hand, for he shut himself in by entering a city with double gates and bars." Keilah was a barred city, and David has gone in there to deliver the people. And so now Saul thinks, "I got this guy. He's in a place now that he can't get out of, and he's so wrong, he's so screwed up, he's so spiritually void of understanding that he thinks it's a blessing from God that David has gone up there and captured the place." That's how ridiculous we can get. When we're out of fellowship, we start justifying sin and behavior traits that are wrong as though they're from God. And Saul's in that frame of mind here now. So he thinks, "Whoa, good deal. I got this guy." So Saul summoned all the people for war. "Go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men." So he gets his team together and they go down there and try to capture him. Now David knew that Saul was plotting evil against him. Probably had some spies around in different places, I guess, is how they know this stuff. So he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." And David said, "O Lord God of Israel, thy servant has heard for certain that Saul is seeking to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. Will the men of Keilah surrender me to his hand?" Looks like there, Tommy, that he's kind of personally involved in the request, doesn't it, himself, but through the ephod that the priest has. He says to God, "Will these guys rat me out in this city that I just came up here and delivered? Will Saul come down just as thy servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell thy servant." And the Lord said, "He will come down. Saul will come after you." Then David said, "Well, will the men of Keilah surrender me to the hand of Saul?" And the Lord said, "They will surrender you. They will rat you out, David. These people that you just came up here and delivered, risk your life and limb to deliver from the Philistines, they will hand you over to Saul." Thank you very much, Keilahites. And yet David still fought the Lord's fights, battled the Lord's enemies right along. But the Lord has told him now that they'll turn him in and rat him out. So then David and his men, about 600, so he's picked up a few guys, they arose and departed from Keilah, and they went wherever they could go. When it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, he gave up the pursuit. So what he thought was an advantageous situation there of having David pinned into this walled city, that fell apart, so he gave up. And David stayed in the wilderness in the strongholds and remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. So they move out of that city and go on to another place. Come on down here now. We're down into this area down here. This is the wilderness of Ziph down here. Now David became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. Saul can't find David, but Jonathan can. They should have put Jonathan in charge from the beginning, shouldn't he? He's a much more impressive guy than his father. So he comes and finds David and tried to encourage him, verse 16. Thus he said to him, "Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you, and Saul, my father, knows that also." So Jonathan thought that David would ultimately, of course, inherit the kingdom, and Jonathan would be sort of his second in command, would work with him and so on. And he thinks his father knows that too. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. So they split back up, and by the way, that's the last meeting between these two guys. Best friend David ever had was Jonathan. Best friend Jonathan ever had was David. But unfortunately, Jonathan's going to die with his father, and he will never serve alongside David in anything because he won't last that long. So then the Ziphites came up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is David not hiding with us in the strongholds at Horsh on the hill of Hikalah, which is on the south of Jehimon? Now then, O king, come down according to all the desire of your soul to do so, and for our part we shall surrender him to the king's hand." And so Saul said, "Well, may you be blessed of the Lord, for you have had compassion on me." And once again, we see this ridiculous thinking on Saul's part, that he thinks God has brought about this wonderful opportunity for him to kill David. "Go now, make for sure and investigate and see this place where the haunt is and who has seen him there, for I am told that he is very cunning. So go get some specific directions. Get your GPSs all set up so I know exactly where this guy is. So look and learn about the hiding places where he hides himself, and return to me with certainty, and I'll go with you. And it shall come about, if he is in the land, that I will search him out among all the thousands of Judah. So you guys go get the detail, and we'll go get him." So then Saul arose and went to Ziph before, they arose and went to Ziph before Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in the Arabah, to the south of Jeshimon. When Saul and his men went to seek him, they told David, and he came down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. When Saul heard it, he pursued David in the wilderness of Maon. Then Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize them. In other words, what's happening here is David's on one side of a mountain, Saul and his army is on the other side of a mountain. Saul and his army is going to peel around this mountain to catch David on the backside, and he can't get away. So he's in a trap, in essence, because Saul is going to surround him, and it's not looking real good here. But a messenger came to Saul saying, "Hurry, come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land." So Saul returned from pursuing David, and he went to meet the Philistines. Therefore they called that place the Rock of Escape. And David went up from there and stayed in the strongholds of En-Gedi. So he comes from down in this region here where this trap almost was laid, and he goes over to a place called En-Gedi over here. So in this particular instance, who did the Lord use to preserve and to save David from Saul's pursuit? What caused this situation to turn out okay for David? Yeah, the Philistines. He used their great enemy to detract Saul away from this confrontation, this trap, and pull him away. So he's used all of David's family, friends, the king of Achish, the Philistine guy. He's now using the Philistine army. All sorts of different means that God has used to deliver David from Saul's hand all of this time. And when we leave off here this morning, which we will do now, he's over at this place called En-Gedi, and this is an interesting place. We'll talk about it next week. But he's over right there, right now. So, what have we seen so far? We've seen a man of rather remarkable, admirable character, when walking by faith, do very well. He's blessed of God. And he's very impressive in his service before God. But when he walks by fear, he starts to lie, and people start to die as a result. So rather than trusting the Lord, he's trusting at times even the Lord's enemies, which is almost inexplicable. The very people that David's out there killing every opportunity he gets, he's going to trust them. So we're seeing, as we do with all men, some high points in their spiritual walk and some low points in their spiritual walk. Our sanctification during this day and age is not a straight line with a nice upward slant to it, is it? It's a series of ups and downs, ups and downs. We hope it has an upward bias to it, but it may not. It may be horizontal, or it may even be downward bias. But the same thing that we experience in our sanctification in this era are the things we're seeing illustrated in David's life here through these various incidents as well. Some positives, some negatives. Walking by faith, they're positives. Walking by fear, they're negatives. So we're seeing kind of a mixed bag of character being displayed by this man of God as he varies his trust and his walk before God. Any questions or comments about anything we've seen so far in the way his life is unfolding? His life illustrates a lot of our lives as well. Yeah, Dawn?
It's interesting in what happened at Keilah, because God told David what could have happened. It didn't happen. So his omniscience included the possible, not just the real things that
mm-hmm.
were. Because Saul never did come then and never did capture David.
Yeah. And here, he kind of sucked him away with the Philistines. They raid someplace and he's about ready to get to David and I got to go attack these guys. And he pulls him off of David's trail using the ever-present Philistines in their conflicts. Any other questions or comments? Well, since you were so good before class, I'm going to give you some time off here. Yeah, Tommy?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like that God did not give up on David because of what he was.
Oh, yeah. On the contrary, absolutely. Yeah, we will see. And it is spoken of David that he was a man after God's own heart. So there are traits in this man that are very much like God's thinking. And we'll see those more as we go along, too. So absolutely did not give up on him. His anointed was not given up on by any means. All right, we'll let you all roll. And see you next Sunday, Lord willing.